We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. willpledge.org. Now here's your program.
From Illinois Public Media, this is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580, 90.9 FM HD2, online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Our guest today is journalist Anna Bernasek. As she covered the financial crisis of 2008, she thought, the effects will be with us for decades. Then she asked, what do we do now? That is one of the questions she explores in her book, The Economics of Integrity, From Dairy Farmers to Toyota, How Wealth is Built on Trust and What That Means for Our Future. Toyota is, at the moment, a very interesting subject. We'll be sure this afternoon, among other topics, to look at the company's history, where it is now, and its efforts to rebuild the public's trust. Listeners, I invite you to join us with your questions and comments. You may join us with a telephone call or by email. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Our toll-free number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL, and the email address will-talk@illinois.edu. Anna Bernasek's reporting on finance and the economy has appeared in many publications, including the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the International Herald Tribune. Anna Bernasek's book, The Economics of Integrity, is published by Harper Studio. Again, the phone numbers, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL, and will-talk@illinois.edu is the email address. Anna Bernasek, good afternoon. Welcome.
Hello, Celeste. How are you?
I'm fine. And you?
Good, thanks.
Good. Well, now, when you use the word integrity, you say you are talking about more than a virtue. How do you define integrity?
Right. I mean, when we think about it conventionally, we think of integrity as moral rectitude, honor, honesty. You know, you'd find that all in the dictionary. But there is an economic view of integrity, and that is as a relationship of trust. And what it essentially is, Celeste, is going back to the nuts and bolts of what makes this market, this capitalist economy work. And it's almost, if you like, lifting the lid off it and looking at the very basics. And what those basics are is this relationship of integrity and trust, which exists in any economic transaction. Sorry, I have to get it out there. So any transaction in the economy, whether you're buying or selling, trading, borrowing, or lending, you know, has this relationship of integrity and trust at its heart. And when you have that, you have an asset that produces economic value. So that's the sort of the basic economic view of what integrity is.
Yeah, you say integrity is the goose that lays the golden egg. How valuable is it?
It's incredibly valuable. I mean, it's what makes this economy go. It is essential for any economic activity. It's something, though, that economists tend to just assume. Whenever they think about the economy, they just assume integrity is there. But what I've done is I've really said, look, let's not just assume. Let's look at it, see how important it is, because if we do that, we can actually learn to protect it and promote it and then create more wealth.
Now, you compare the qualities of a conventional view of integrity with a strategic vision of integrity. You want to share those two lists with us to give listeners a really concrete idea of what you're talking about.
Right. I mean, in the conventional way we think of integrity, we think of it as a private virtue. You know, it's entirely up to you. It's your business. If you're good, upright, upstanding, then that's great, but, you know, it's none of my business and it doesn't concern me. But the strategic view is actually, it's all about us, because if you do something, and we've seen this in the sort of subprime crisis, if a few bad apples do something wrong, not necessarily break the law, but just, you know, knowingly do bad things, it can affect all of us. And that's the point of economic integrity, that it's actually a shared asset, that when we all do the right thing, we benefit, but if some people do the wrong thing, we actually all sort of lose out. So that's one sort of aspect of it. The other aspect is that conventionally it's about morality, but in the strategic view, it's about good economics. And, you know, probably the last couple of ideas are conventionally, you know, what we normally do with integrity is we sort of complain about other people and try and catch bad guys. But a strategic view actually sees it as capturing opportunities and creating wealth.
Mm. Shouldn't we capture the bad guys, though?
Well, you know, Celeste, I know it. I mean, it feels good to do that. But in reality, just in terms of pure sort of economics, you know, say, for instance, the subprime, I mean, catching bad guys doesn't actually create wealth, and it doesn't move us out from where we are. So the notion is really, let's set up a system, not that catches bad guys, but actually gets us to do more good. So instead of trying to limit people, you're actually creating a system where the rules set people free to do the right thing. And it's just a change in focus. So instead of trying to limit people and catch them when they do something wrong, it's about promoting more of what they do that's right.
Mm. Let's go to your starting point in the book, The Financial Crisis of 2008. It has been, you say, first and foremost, a crisis of integrity.
Mm.
And you say the marketplace was turned into essentially a casino.
Mm-hmm.
And you say the effects will be with us for a very long time. What are the near-term and long-term consequences of this crisis of integrity?
Well, I think, you know, clearly the economic recession that we're in, you know, that's sort of first and foremost. And also, I mean, it really has affected globally, you know, economies around the world. You know, the other sort of effects, though, I think, are, you know, this sort of lack of trust now in the financial sector. And, you know, a lack of trust, again, in the banks and in credit card companies and all those sort of companies dealing with their finances. And I think that's something that's lingering because we're not actually dealing with it in a straightforward manner. I know myself in my experience, I lost a lot of money in the stock market, and particularly I was invested in Lehman Brothers. And I haven't been too eager to get back in the market. And so even sort of from my perspective, I feel that there is a lingering lack of trust in our financial system. And I think that's something that's going to be with us for a long time unless we're starting to take on some of the reforms that are necessary to bring back confidence.
How could our financial system be better in terms of disclosure and transparency?
Well, I think definitely in terms of disclosure, we have these very complicated products, all the sort of the derivatives that, you know, for a start, we don't even know how many derivatives are traded on a daily basis. So, for instance, you know, with the stock exchange, you know, we have a stock exchange, and at the end of the day, they tally up how many shares were traded, what was the value, all that kind of stuff. We don't even have that in terms of the derivatives market. So that's just one basic idea that really shouldn't affect anybody's business one way or another. You know, I mean, it's very hard to find people who would really be against trying to have a system that actually disclosed how many sort of derivatives were traded and what was the value. So I think that would be a start. What would be probably more controversial is, you know, big financial players, whether they're hedge funds or insurance groups or banks or any of these sort of big investors really disclosing their positions on a regular and timely basis. And I think obviously that would be very controversial, but for those players who are trying to protect their own position, but it would be really beneficial for the public.
How so? Where would the value come from? What would it give us?
Yeah, it would, you know, for a start, the whole thing, you know, we saw with Madoff would, you know, disappear. That whole sort of issue of being able to, you know, completely lie and cheat in the way that he did with his funds. You know, if that was brought into the open and if his positions were disclosed, it would be obvious to people that something was going on here. So, I mean, number one, it would really be beneficial in that sense. Number two, the thing about financial information, when you are the one doing the, you know, keeping it to yourself, it's not really, I mean, it's beneficial to you because you have this information, but it's not necessarily beneficial to the public. The public actually, once it's out in the open, people can make up their minds about whether they want to invest with you if you're a hedge fund, or whether they want to avoid you, or if they're a bank and they're looking to invest in you and they have all the details. So it's basically what we've done with the stock exchange. We've opened up everything in terms of, you know, when a company is listed on the stock exchange, they have to report their earnings, their balance sheet, all this kind of thing, so investors then can make up their mind whether they want to invest in it. And that's, I think, critical for big financial players. Not so much if you want to invest with them, but if you want to have any kind of dealings with them. And that gives you the information you need to make a good judgment.
Mm. It seems a lot of people don't like banks these days, but we pretty much all trust them. Are banks adequately regulated today? And should they be prohibited from taking on extreme risk? And then I guess you have to ask, what is extreme risk? What is acceptable risk?
Mm. You know, Celeste, today banks are, surprisingly, one of the most regulated financial institutions. I mean, they actually have a lot of rules and laws and, you know, all sorts of things they have to follow. And yet, it proved really inadequate in this last financial crisis. And that's because of all the off-balance sheet investment opportunities, and namely the complex sort of derivative instruments. And so, on the one hand, we certainly don't want to give them more onerous rules and regulations. Yet, on the other hand, there's this whole area of the market that really they have been able to sort of get around their rules and sort of operate in. So we do really need to think about that, and I think there are international agencies that are working on how you can actually get some of those complex instruments and sort of make sure that they have a value and they're known, the risk and all that type of thing. But ultimately, I mean, I think that we need to ask what sort of role do banks have in investing in very complex instruments where the risks are very high? And, you know, is this really something that we should take a stand on and say, you know what, that's not a good idea for you guys to invest in?
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Today we're taking a look at the role trust plays in our economy, indeed the global economy. Our guest is financial reporter Anna Bernasek. She is the author of The Economics of Integrity, From Dairy Farmers to Toyota, How Wealth is Built on Trust and What That Means for Our Future. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us with a telephone call or by email. The telephone number's 333-9455. That's the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Our toll-free number, 800-222-9455. And the email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. We have a listener waiting to talk with us to join the conversation this afternoon. This listener is in Naperville on line four. Hi.
Good afternoon. Yeah, good topic. People, I think, need to start, I think high schools and colleges both need to start taking lessons on financial responsibility. I mean, I laugh at all the excuses people throw out there, the banking system and the government, when we know what the problem was. And I mean, pretty much I think most of the people in this country understand finances. Now, you were saying that the banking system, you know, I think they ended.
Is the listener still there? I think we lost him. That call got cut off somehow or other. I don't know. You want to pick it up, Anna, maybe in terms of what our personal role?
Well, it's sure. I mean, I do think, clearly we can't sort of blame anybody else. I mean, unless they are actually breaking the law and cheating us. Do you know what I mean? I mean, that's obviously not on. But I think in terms of our responsibility, I mean, you know, we can't blame anybody else when we're applying for a mortgage or, you know, a credit card or any of these things. You know, we have to be on top of it. We have to understand what the rules are, what our rights are, all that type of thing. But Celeste, I would argue that we as consumers should be out there telling the banks, telling the credit card companies, telling the health insurance companies even, simplify. You know, if you make it so complicated, then it's very difficult for us to understand. Plus, it's also a potential that we are going to make a mistake or somebody's going to make a mistake. And I think there's a real role for consumers to say, hang on, I'm not going to sign up for this that has pages and pages and pages of fine print that I can't really follow. You know, let's find a credit card that actually makes sense today. Let's, you know, go to a health insurance company, perhaps that's actually going to make things simple and sensible. And so I think there's actually a great opportunity for business today to sort of build trust with the customers. And I think there's a role for consumers to demand that.
Mm. Well, next, let's talk about Toyota. The history of this company goes back to the close of the 19th century.
Right.
Sekichi Toyoda was an inventor who was not pleased with his first crack at a steam-powered loom.
Right.
The issue was the quality of the cloth. Tell us the story.
It is. It's a fascinating story. So Toyota basically, you know, he saw that the weaving was just such a central part of the fabric of the life of women out there and in the countryside. And he saw how difficult it was for them, and he thought he could make it better. He was sort of a tinkerer and inventor. So he invented this loom that powered itself. But he, you know, he saw that it often still made mistakes. And so he wanted to invent something that actually was foolproof. And he did. So that any time there was a run, the loom would stop and you could correct it. Because otherwise, if it didn't stop, you know, if there wasn't this sort of automatic correction in a way, it would build in that defect into the fabric. And so, you know, he not only did he make a sort of a steam-powered loom, but he had this invention that it would stop if there was a defect and, you would be able to correct it. And it was very successful. And it was that idea that he basically then gave to his son, who was the foundation of the modern Toyota Corporation. And it has been a philosophy in the company right back then that you catch problems before they're built in, and you resolve them, and you bring things out into the open so that you can solve problems. So, and it's been that philosophy that really created this incredible, incredible automaker, which for me was actually, you know, then living through what we've seen in the last couple of months was absolutely shocking.
Yeah. Now, just to maybe talk about this just a little bit more here in terms of quality, as I understand it, a Toyota assembly line, if there's a problem and they can't fix it as the car continues to move down the line, they stop the line.
Right.
So that's something to think about. And then this was interesting. You know, sometimes we forget our history, and this is very recent history. In 2005, you note, the company recalled more vehicles than it sold. What happened there?
Right. There was a ring of defects, and it was the first time really where, because Toyota had been, you know, sort of creeping up as this competitor and doing very, very well, you know, compared to the big three U.S. automakers. And then they hit this period where they just had one problem after the other, one recall after the other. And it was this period where, you know, GM, Ford, and Chrysler, and everybody was saying, ha, you know, finally, you know, it sort of happened to you too. But they really went through this sort of soul searching, and it was a very, very hard time in terms of the quality somehow in the U.S. just wasn't matching the quality worldwide of the vehicles. And they really came in and they made changes, I think, in the production line, and they were able to quite quickly reduce the sort of the recall issues. So, you know, it was a very hard time. They came through it. But I have to say, Celeste, this past period seemed, to me at least, a lot harder because there weren't a lot of tangible things. You know, for instance, I mean, the main problem has been this unintended acceleration, which I think really caught them by surprise because they couldn't pin it down. I think in the 2005, they quickly could find the problems and they could quickly correct it. But this one stumped them because it wasn't obvious what was going wrong here. And I think that they've been all over it and they've thrown, you know, all their best people. And I think they really feel that the changes they've made have fixed the problem. And, you know, they're all done. But, of course, now they have to work on that sort of rebuilding trust with the broader community.
Hmm. This is The Afternoon Magazine. Our guest today is financial reporter Anna Bernasek, author of The Economics of Integrity. My name is Celeste Quinn. Let's take a telephone call now from a listener in Pontiac on line one. Hi.
Hi. I'm trying to understand a little bit what you're saying. I'm not really, it's not sounding very good to me. I have to go back to the mortgage information. Yes, certainly you have to research when you do a mortgage, but people were being deliberately lied to, deliberately misled. Information they brought in was not being presented. I mean, there's where the ethics comes in. And yes, we better be catching those bad guys and not giving them incentives to make money, because that's what created, I would say, a lot of the problems. And again, with the derivatives, people didn't have a clue what was going on. Even the companies didn't understand those things. So if you could explain a little better what you're saying.
Sure. No. I think, I mean, look, I'm not saying let, if you break the law, let these people go free. Not by any stretch of the imagination. I was really talking about where we can actually get more bang for our buck. And I think that ultimately, you know, of course, you have to be vigilant. That's actually part of promoting integrity, is actually being vigilant about the law and holding people accountable when they break the law. So absolutely, if people are found to break the law, if they have lied, if they have cheated, then definitely they need to be held accountable. I was talking more in terms of the actual system that we have, where we can actually promote more wealth. And I think the way we can do that is not by setting up laws that try and catch you if you do something wrong, but by setting up the system or the rules that let people do good, if you like. So let me try and make this concrete. Celeste, do I have a minute to just sort of make this a bit concrete?
Certainly,
okay.
Certainly.
Okay, so what I'm talking about in rules is a company like eBay, when they first started, they created integrity from scratch. And the way they did that was, they didn't sort of create a whole bunch of rules on their eBay system saying, if you do this wrong, you know, you'll be penalized, or if you do that, you'll be penalized. They sort of created basic guidelines that let people buy and sell on eBay, but they were two basic principles. You know, if you're a buyer, then you better follow through with your bid. And if you're a seller, you better deliver that product in the way that you told the buyer it would be delivered. And those were the two basic rules. And those rules have allowed millions and millions of people to trade, to get satisfaction, to get things they couldn't otherwise have. And so that's what I'm talking about. I'm talking about when we're thinking about setting up our system, I mean, reforming the financial system, or, creating a new company on the Internet. If you can keep this idea in mind that you want to have rules that let people do the right thing and that way they can create wealth, rather than set up a whole bunch of rules that tries to catch you out if you do the wrong thing. And the ultimate penalty on eBay is if you do cheat or you do break those two basic rules, then you can get kicked off. And they're very vigilant about that.
Hmm.
So I'm not sure if that's goes all the way to answer the listener's question. But It's a combination of setting up very smart, efficient, clear, and easy to understand rules, and then obviously holding people accountable to those.
Another case study we might want to talk about here is that of dairy farmers.
Mm-hmm.
You say at the outset of the 20th century, not all that long ago, a huge factor in infant mortality was bad milk. How bad was it?
It was, you know, I mean, it was pretty bad for a lot of airborne sickness. And infants often, I think that... It was something which, I mean, parents could, you know, often watch their kids get sick and even die in these cases. And, I mean, we just don't even hear about that anymore because the incidence of getting sick or even dying from milk, I think, is just being driven down to such a small percentage. And that was something that the milk industry was very smart about because everybody got together and said, you know, We need to make sure that we create a very safe product. And so everybody worked together from the farmers. This was in the 1920s, you know, from the farmers to scientists to the milk producers, the people who made machinery for milk production. Everybody got together to devise certain standards or rules in which milk would be safe. So it was sort of an incredible coming together. And those standards, the Grade A Pasteurization Act today, those standards, I mean, are the gold standard today that we all operate from to create milk. And it goes a long way to explaining why we don't even think about it when we, you know, pour milk on our cornflakes. We just assume it's safe and we drink it.
Mm. Today we purchase foodstuffs from around the world. What's your assessment of the integrity of global food safety?
It's a very interesting question because, on the one hand, we really have an enormous amount of integrity in our food system. You know, and the way that I would explain that is, you know, you go to any restaurant, you don't even think about it. You sit down, you eat, you go home. You don't think, you know, I'm going to get poisoned or I have to be careful here or have they done this or have they done that? I mean, how many times, you know, you're driving, you stop at McDonald's, you eat McDonald's, you go, you know, anywhere we go in the country, anytime we're at a corner store, we buy milk, we buy cheese, fruit and veg, whatever we buy or whatever restaurant we go into, we don't really think about it. So I think we have this enormous integrity built up in our food system. On the other hand, there is a very interesting, you know, phenomena, which is we sort of, as we've become, I think, much more aware of health and things like that, we've become more discerning about, say, for instance, you know, the medicines, the antibiotics used in our meat production, the way that our chickens are used to produce eggs. And I think that, you know, we've also realized that, in a sense, our whole food system has gone a little bit maybe to the extreme where it's become so industrialized in one way that we've lost that, the whole, in a way, I want to say integrity of the food, but that's not the right word. I mean, we sort of lost that essence of making it good and wholesome, and it's become, you know, too sort of industrialized and too extreme in that way. And so therefore you see the backlash and the move towards local and the move towards organic and all these other sort of systems where we find, you know, we have much more trust in it. So I think it's very interesting because I think we do have a real base of integrity there. And yet on the other hand, our knowledge and our tastes and our expectations have changed to sort of demand more.
Mm. You know, this is something that I thought about when I was reading the book. Could a nation's neglect of integrity cost it not just market share for one thing, but for many products?
Absolutely. And I think we saw that with China. And we saw that with the milk scandal. It was in 2008, if I'm remembering correctly. And it was one of those things where it was a very good example of integrity because these, you know, when everybody was behaving in that sort of milk production, then everybody benefited. But as soon as you had these players and, you know, they used the melamine to pad out the milk powder, as soon as you had that, it decimated the industry for everybody. So the poor farmers that had scraped together money to buy cows because suddenly there was real demand for milk in the country had to slaughter their cows and basically lost everything. And so it went all the way down the chain until there was a sort of a backlash. I don't know if you remember at the time, Celeste, but there was a real backlash against anything made in China because it was just sort of this feeling that could you really trust it? Is this, you know, and countries, especially I think in Europe and other Asian countries said, no, we're not buying any Chinese dairy products, any related products, any of that. And they actually, you know, put an embargo for a while on it. But it just sort of flowed over to everything Chinese, you know, made in China that we sort of had a little bit more of a doubt about. So it definitely, you can see the economic effects of a lack of integrity, absolutely.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Today we're talking about the role trust plays in our economy and the international economy. Our guest is financial reporter Anna Bernasek. She is the author of The Economics of Integrity, From Dairy Farmers to Toyota, How Wealth is Built on Trust and What That Means for Our Future. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with a phone call or by email, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455 by email, will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, how does a company concerned about quality and also concerned about cost, how does a successful company weigh those concerns and continue to make a product that people will be willing to purchase?
That is a very good question because it isn't easy, especially today. You know, I mean, it's a tough, tough business environment. I would argue, though, that if you're not focusing on integrity and your integrity, you really are jeopardizing your long-term wealth-creating potential. And so I think that you really need to look at the short term and what you're doing to sort of survive in relation to the long term. And as long as you're doing things in the short term that will enhance or help, I'd even go as far to say as long as you're not hurting your long-term potential, then, you know, you're doing fine. But I think, you know, Celeste, it's interesting because when I wrote the book, I really focused on this idea of what integrity is and showing how it underpins the economy and then showing how you can create more. But I didn't, and I specifically wanted to provide a resource for business as well as policymakers and individuals. But it was only after I wrote the book that I really started to realize what it meant for business. If they really want to focus on integrity, what does that actually mean in concrete terms, in practical terms for them? And as I've been sort of talking to people around the country, I've realized, you know, businesses really, especially small business, you know, they really are having a tough time, and they want to, you know, figure out some of this stuff. And so I actually just recently was thinking, you know, of a list of practical things. And, you know, one of them that I have been talking to people about is this idea of brand, because your brand as a business is your promise to your customers. And you need to think long and hard about what promise am I making, and can I keep it? Am I keeping it? And so that's, you know, one very tangible way that companies can think about their integrity. Another way is reliability, because so often you're thinking in business about just trying to get it done, you know, and what it should be about is going that extra mile, not cutting corners, not trying to do things quickly, but really trying to be absolutely reliable. And I think the last point for business is continuous improvement, just figuring out, always thinking about how can I do this better for the customer? How can I do this better for my employees, my suppliers, my shareholders? And I think those three principles, I mean, I think there's a lot more we can sort of think about, but I just wanted to get those out there to leave people with some, you know, something practical, tangible that they can take away and think about for their own business.
If this is so valuable, why aren't we better at protecting it and investing in it in terms of making decisions about where to put our money?
Yes. Celeste, it's a great question, and it's something I thought about, you know, as I was working through this. And the reason is we have not before made the link between integrity and a financial payoff. We don't traditionally think about, we traditionally think, look, if you do the right thing in business, you probably will lose. I mean, that's how we tend to think about it. And what I was trying to do with my book is get the message out, get the proof out there to people that integrity is essential for a financial payoff. If you want to make a profit, if you want to make money in the long run, you have to act with integrity. And I think that the more that that gets out there, the more people realize that that's the way you have to go. I think we will start seeing people focused on it and looking for ways to really do it well.
Can we apply this strategic way of looking at integrity to politics and government?
I think we can. I think we definitely can. I think that politics and government is going to be slightly different in the sense that it's about public service. And what I'm talking about is really, for profit. I mean, I'm talking about our economy, which is, you know, the free market capitalist economy. But I definitely think we can. And I think we know from what President Obama has been saying that, you know, he feels that there's this real deficit of trust in government. And I think we can all sort of see that. And I think definitely the principles of how you promote integrity in the economy, I think we could definitely use in politics. And I think it would be very helpful. And so the way I've thought about promoting integrity is, you know, I call it the DNA of integrity, which is disclosure, norms, and accountability. And I think when you could basically think about those same things, and I know President Obama talks a lot about disclosure in terms of politics, but it's amazing, Celeste, just even disclosure, how far that goes in helping promote integrity. Because when things are hidden, it's just, you know, like a red flag for any kind of bad behavior. But when you bring things out in the open, it's amazing how well people will behave. So even just thinking about that, I think, would be a big step.
Yeah. We've got another caller waiting to talk with us. Before, though, I get to this listener, I do want to ask a follow-up here. What's the, I don't know if you've thought about this or not, but what's the cost of corruption in public life?
I think it's a very good question. I don't have a figure. I haven't sat down and figured out in a money value.
Yeah.
I think you could do it. I think there would be smart people who actually could come up with an estimate. But
well, if you look at places in the world where people are reluctant to invest,
yes,
or go into business, I think that says something about integrity is important.
Absolutely. If you're looking at it in terms of developing countries and developed countries, then you tend to see the correlation between when there is, you know, very low corruption, you know, you tend to see that they are a high wealth, a developed country, and vice versa. So it definitely, there definitely is a correlation in terms of corruption and economic development.
Yeah, and I also think it would be interesting to look at that at the state level. Here in the state of Illinois, we've faced just a horrendous bout of corruption charges in state government, and we're not the only one. It's the only state. It's happened elsewhere. And I just wonder if that has an effect on who's willing to locate that and what the cost of doing business is in terms,
yes,
of what goes under the table, et cetera.
Yes. So. I think you've hit onto a really great area. And for people out there, you know, anybody listening who is, you know, writing, thinking about a dissertation or thinking about research or any, you know, I mean, it's a terrific,
yeah,
terrific area.
Well, I'm not ready to go back to school, but but if I was, I think I might start there in political science and economics. Well,
yeah,
let's take that call now,
okay,
from this listener who's been waiting so patiently in St. Joseph on line one. Hi.
Hi. I tuned in a little late, so some of this may be redundant. I'll try not to be. I was very interested how you're relating integrity to financial gain, because it may be the only way that a lot of integrity can happen. It seems that I often think of integrity as not what you can gain financially, but what you can gain morally. And it kind of is a quandary for me, but I understand that that's how people are sometimes. It seems that it's more related to greed than it is to trying to do the right thing. And that's just a comment that I had. And then the question that I had, I really wonder about our meat supply, and maybe you've already talked about all of this, the chicken supplies, that sort of thing. But when I was a kid, we never had those problems, especially out on the farm when we did our own butchering. We had meat that didn't make you sick, and you didn't have to be so careful. And the meat didn't smell like it smells now either. And the chickens coming out of these corporate farms that are motivated primarily by dollars, and they mistreat these animals, these chickens and things, and hogs being transported in freezing cold weather. I wonder about the integrity of all of that. Mm. And how do you motivate that? I mean, to get people to not do those things to us. So it's a long question, and I'm sure I kind of, but I'll sit and wait for any answers that you have.
Okay. Thanks for the call.
I think it is. It's a tremendous area and a tremendous concern, I think, for all of us, the whole food supply. And so I think that, for a start, thank you to the caller who asked that, because I think we can do, well, number one, you know, the whole sort of movement towards organic meat, organic chicken, all of that sort of thing. I mean, ultimately, if our meat, if we do absolutely nothing and it continues the way it is, and we all sort of move, become vegetarians and move away from that, well, then, that's sort of the ultimate. But I'm not suggesting that, and that also takes a long time. But definitely, that's sort of the market force. I think that part of the problem has been we've become so efficient with the whole industrialization. And that's the thing. When you think back 20, 30, 40, 50 years, when you could have chickens running around and you could, at the local farm and you get your chickens there. I mean, we moved completely away from that and into this incredibly efficient and incredibly powerful and quite amazing food system. But we need to make it better. I mean, there's just no question. And I think, so part of it, I think, is consumer demand saying, you know what, I'm not going to eat that stuff anymore because I don't believe in it. And then you see other businesses come in, whether it's organic or whether it's not organic, but people that are doing it on a smaller scale and, really focusing on the quality and the sort of the way that they handle the animals in a humane and in a decent and clean way. So I think there's a tremendous business opportunity there. But I think the other thing is regulations and rules. And I think that we need, as a society, to say what's acceptable and what's not acceptable in terms of how the food and how these animals are treated and how they're killed and how they're brought to us. So I think it's something that, as a society, we need to be thinking about and we need to be vocal about.
And now I have two questions by email for you from a listener in Urbana. Number one, did you find useful Francis Fukuyama's book, Trust, The Social Virtues and the Creation of Prosperity?
I have a terrible admission, which is that I have not read that book. So I'm afraid to say, I mean, I cannot lie on this. I did not read that book, and I actually had not been aware of it. So It might be something, to put on my list.
Okay. And then the second question from the listener, have you looked into using a game called The Prisoner's Dilemma for building trust between competitors?
That is something, yes. That's something that economists use when they think about trust. And it basically gives them the answer where, really, trust is something you can build over the long term. I came to the same type of conclusion in my own sort of study, but I didn't do it through the prisoner's dilemma, although I was aware of it and I understand, the research that economists have done with it. But they basically have found that when they repeat these games, that if you believe that your relationship will be long-term, then, it tends to have much more trust in it than if it's like a one-off, then there is much more potential for cheating and mistrust and things like that. And I think that's critical when we think about integrity and trust, because if you're thinking about relationships over the long term, I think it has enormous benefit to our economy and our society, because number one, you really are thinking about creating wealth over the long term, and you're thinking about products and services that will satisfy and be valued by consumers over the long term. So it feeds into the whole sustainability argument of how we create wealth.
Okay, I'm going to take a chance here and take one last call. We'll have to be brief on
all
around. Peoria, line four, hi.
Hi, I'll be quick. I noticed that Walmart, of all people, is going to start buying locally grown produce in response to demand, and not because they, you know, have a moral stance on it, but because people are demanding integrity.
Yes.
In response to that other guy's call. Okay, bye.
I think that's tremendous. I mean, it's so good, you know, to see that they're doing that. So, I think I do, Celeste, I go back to tremendous opportunity for business right now is building integrity and trust.
And there we have to leave it. My thanks this afternoon to Anna Bernasek, author of The Economics of Integrity. The book is published by Harper Studio. You'll find our guest online at www.annabernasek.com. It's Anna with two N's, A-N-N-A, and then the last name Bernasek, B-E-R-N-A-S-E-K. Anna, thank you so much.
Thank you.